We left off last time in the Gemara and Daf Zayin Amud Aleph in Brachos, and we were up to the second medium width line. So right where the Tosis and end, two lines below that, the beginning of the line. So we're still in the middle of a sequence. The Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Yose. One interesting note, the statement that Rabbi Yose is about, that Rabbi Yochanan is about to quote in the name of Rabbi Yose. And remember, he didn't hear it from Rabbi Yose. Rabbi Yose was multiple generations before Rabbi Yochanan. But this statement is going to be repeated on the very next Amud, towards the top of Zayin Amud Beis, about 8, 9, 10 lines down, the exact same statement. But there it's Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, instead of Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Yose. But it's the same statement. So I noticed that you may not have in your Gemara, but the Tzlach, there's a collection of notes on the side of my edition in the Oz V'Hadar Shas, and he quotes a passage from the Tzlach. The Tzlach is a sefer, stands for Tzil Nefesh Chaya. It was a commentary on the Gemara written by a very famous personality. His responsa are much more famous and outside of the world of the Beis Medrash than his commentary on the Gemara, and that was the Node Behuda, Rabbi Cheska Landau of Prague, who was probably the foremost authority, certainly in the lands of Ashkenaz in the mid-18th century. So the Node Behuda, as we usually call him, he also wrote a sefer on Shas, Chidushim. I believe it's called Siyun LeNefesh Chaya. If I'm not mistaken, it was dedicated, the name was his mother. I think his mother's name was Chaya. I think he says that in the introduction. So anyway, in the Tzlach, they quote from the Tzlach the following comment. How is it on this Amud that it's quoted in the name of Rabbi Yose, and the next Amud, the exact same statement, is quoted in the name of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai? And I don't know if this is bad news for you, but when we finish the sequence of Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Yose on this daf, we're going to go to a new sequence of Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And we're going to get a series of those. I promise you that within about two daf, the tangents are finally going to end. But in the meantime, what is it doing? Who said it? So the Tzlach makes a very interesting comment, which sort of illuminates a little bit how he sees, I think fundamentally correctly so, the editorial process of the Gemara. He says that apparently Rabbi Yochanan must have heard this statement, this very same memra that we're about to read. He heard it both from Rabbi Yose, and he heard it from Mishum Bar Yochai. And what the Gemara has doing here, what the editors of this parak are doing, is they've chosen to present collections of statements in Agada of particular names, particular tradents. So in this, on Daf Zayin Amud Aleph, we're quoting Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Yose, and then when we're finished with that, the Gemara then is going to quote this packet of material, which is Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. It happens to be that statement is the one statement that appears in both packets. Essentially, this is what I would call, you can term it source criticism, which is perfectly kosher when it comes to rabbinic literature, not so kosher when it comes to biblical literature. But this is really a basic method of source criticism, right? You have two collections of material, they're stuck in one after the other here, and there's a repetition because one particular statement happened to appear in both blocks of material. Okay, fine. That said, the Gemara says the following. Amram Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Yose, again, second medium line on Zayin Amud Aleph. Minayin she'im iratzin lo la'adam b'shas kaso. How do you know that you're not supposed to try to appease someone when they're furious, right? Your spouse is flying off the handle, is just furious. Let's say not at you. It probably doesn't make a difference either way. That's not the time to try to appease them. You let them kind of blow off steam, let them calm down a little bit, and then you can try to talk to them. But trying to talk to someone when literally the steam is coming out of their ears is generally not a productive enterprise. So how do you know? Aside from the answer could have been, by the way, common sense and human experience. But the Gemara wants to know, where do we have, the Torah teaches us this principle. So, minayin she'in ratzon lo adam b'shas kaso, v'siv panay yelecho v'hanicho silach. So this pasuk is found in Parshas Kisisa. We read it when we're in shul. We read it Shabbos Chol HaMoed twice a year, if there are two Shabbos Chol HaMoeds. And this is right after the story of the Egel. And Moshe Rabbeinu is engaged in some kind of enigmatic dialogue with God. Not 100% sure exactly what he means. Moshe asks something from God, And that's probably not necessarily what the pshat is right now, but the Gemara reads panay lechu, and panim is sometimes a term that's used for anger. So, for example, in 2 weeks ago's parsha in Achrei Mos Kedoshim, so God says that if the community doesn't wipe out someone who worships the Molech, so God, the Torah says, "Vani etain es panai ba'ishahu." I will direct my panai, my face. The Targum translates, and it's probably the simple sense of the text, rugza. I will direct my anger against that person. So sometimes the word panai means anger. Panim means anger. So God says, panai yelechu, meaning my anger will eventually dissipate, and then vahani chosilach, then I will consider granting you your request. So it's based upon that. As Amar lo Kadosh Baruch Hu Moshe, hamtein li ad sheyavru panim shel za'am va'aniach lach. Wait till sort of my countenance of anger passes, whatever that means. We should say kivayacha. What does it mean? God gets angry. God comes down. God is not human, right? We calm down probably because sometimes we run out of energy to keep our anger going. So God doesn't run out of energy, but God says to Moshe, perhaps to teach him, when my anger passes, then I can. Then you can talk to me and I can grant your request. Okay.
Rabbi, we...
Yes.
Sorry again about the video being absent. If God can tell us, wait for me to calm down, you have to be pretty calm to be able to take a break from your anger, tell someone, wait for me to calm down.
Yes, and then I'll, correct, because God's not actually angry. It's very interesting. The Rambam...
How do you know that maybe it's a principle in the universe? You don't have to be this. Who said you have to be human to be? Again, you're going with Greek ideas that God, there's nothing about God that's human. Maybe it's a kind of, in this universe that God created, the way he plays or acts in this universe, he does take on a kind of, you're calling a human attribute, but it actually may be a principle almost throughout the cosmos. Just like gravity, there's a principle of anger, whatever that means.
It could be, but I'll respond to you with a comment of the Rambam, which doesn't prove anything. Not the Rambam from the Mor Nevuchim, but the Rambam from Hilchos Deos. It's a difficult Rambam because he seems to contradict himself. Whereas in the first parak of Hilchos Deos, the Rambam talks about how all of our character traits should be kind of in the middle. Everything about us, like being angry. You shouldn't get angry very easily or often, but you shouldn't be like
Aristotle's cold.
You shouldn't be stone cold. That you never get angry at all, no matter, even if there's something that's worthy of getting angry. So the Rambam, though, in Perek Beis says the following. The Rambam says that there are a couple of midos that a person should never exhibit. One of them is anger, arrogance and anger. And what he says regarding anger is that a person sometimes has to show anger, but he has to... do what he does. He's only supposed to pretend to be angry. He's not actually supposed to be getting angry. So, right. But sometimes if the Rambam talks about your family is upset, so your family has done something wrong, and so you're getting upset at them. So the Rambam says that you have to look like you're angry, even though you're not actually angry. So you might argue that this is the same thing here, that God pretends he's angry, but he's not actually angry. Okay, I don't know. But anyway, be it as it may, the next step in the Gemara is the following. The next step is a Gemara that some of us have seen a long time ago, which is a Gemara in Avodah Zarah. But it happens to be almost, some of the parts are left out, but it's going to be repeated in parallel here. So the Gemara says the following. The Gemara says, "Umi ika ritcha kame de kucha brichu." Is there such a thing as anger before God? And Sam, this is not your question of, this is not the Aristotelian question. The question is, does odd God ever get angry? So the Gemara says, "In yes, Ditanya ve'elzoim b'chol yom." God, this may not be the pshat, but God gets angry every single day. So now the Gemara asks a question. Interestingly, it's going to ask this question twice because I think there are two different sources merged here. V'kama zama, how long does God get angry for? Some people get angry; they stay angry a long time. Some people stay angry a short time. So the Gemara says, rega. God is angry for a rega. Okay. Then the Gemara says, vikama rega. How long is a rega? So now the Gemara says, echad mechameshes ribo ushmonas alafim ushmona meos ushmona mushano b'sha'a. Okay, one out of 58,888 parts of an hour. By my calculation, it's approximately a 16th of a second. There are other other nuschaos there, but nonetheless, that is the amount of time. Okay, 1/5,888 of a second. Okay.
Where did you come up with this number?
And then the Gemara said, what's that?
How did they get a number like this?
Where I have no idea. There's a note on the side of my Gemara, but it doesn't, that wants to edit the number, except for the number they want to edit to is also not correct. They want to say it's really supposed to be 8,858 or something like that, which is supposed to be the number of Psukim in the Torah. But the real number of Psukim in the Torah is like 5850 something.
Is it any kind of multiple of the numeric value of the word rega? Zuhi rega,
I don't know. Rega is 273. I have no idea. Nothing immediately comes to mind, but I don't know. So anyway, so the Gemara then says, "V'zohi rega, v'ein kol beria yachola lachaveno sosha, chutz mi bilam harasha." No creature in the world was able to focus and identify that particular time that God would get angry, except for Bilam. D'chsiv bei v'yodea das elyon. It says about Bilam that he is yodea das elyon. He knows the mind of God. So now the Gemara is not finished. How do you know that refers to this? So the first Gemara says, what do you mean? Bilam knew God? Hashta das behemta lo havayada. Das Elyon Havayada, and this appears in Avodah Zarah as well. Bilam didn't know what his donkey was thinking. He knew what God was thinking. This donkey kept seeing the angel, and the donkey kept going off the way, and Bilam kept hitting the donkey Bilam didn't understand until God finally opened his eyes and he saw the angel too. Right? So if Das Behemta Layada, then Das Elyon certainly wasn't your dad. The Gemara actually goes on to give in Avodah Zarah, not here. They left out the very interesting part. We learned this many years ago, about how Bilam then has to what Bilam's conversation with his donkey was, and what his donkey suggested that his donkey used to do for Bilam. I'm not going to go into that now, but bottom line is that Bilam, clearly, when Bilam said Yodea Das Elyon, it didn't mean he understood God better than everybody else and he knew what was going on with God. It referred to a very, very specific attribute. I am struck, and I'm sure I probably said this years ago when we learned this Gemara of Avodah Zarah, there's a delightful, wonderful Gemara that we've mentioned previously a few weeks ago, in Meseches Gittin, at the beginning of the seventh parak, the story of Ashmedai, king of the Shadim. And in that story, so I don't remember why I mentioned it then, but in that story, so Shlomo sends Benoyo Ben Yoyada to bring the Shamir, the worm for engraving the stones of the Choshen and the Ephod. And in order to get the Shamir, so Benoyo Ben Yoyada needs Ashmedai's help. And so anyway, he ends up putting Ashmedai in chains. It's got God's name engraved on it, so Ashmedai can't escape. And as he's leading Ashmedai back to Yerushalayim to bring him to Shlomo, Ashmedai does all sorts of strange things. Like he sees an old man stumbling on the side of the road, he helps him. He passes by the sorcerer and he starts laughing. You know, all these things that happens. And at the end of the story, Shabanoyo asks Ashmedai, okay, why did you do this? Why did you do that? When he saw the sorcerer, who was making predictions about what was going to happen, and he laughed, Ashmedai said to Benayahu, there was a treasure buried right underneath his feet, and he didn't know about that. And you expect to believe him on things that he's predicting for the future? It always kind of struck me, it's the same thing about Bilam. Das behemto lo yada, das elyon yada? So the Gemara says, no. Ella, at the end of the first wide line in the Gemara, melameh shtahaya yodea lechavein oso shah, shakadosh baruch hu koespa. Bilam's one talent, why he was so talented, is he could figure out what was that moment that God got angry at the world, because that was the time he was going to curse the Jewish people, because God would have been in a bad mood, and when someone's in a bad mood, in quotes, so then that's the opportunity to prod him further. So the Gemara said, now, the fact that Bilam was a danger to the Jewish people, because he knew that moment, and he could have used that or abused it to curse the Jewish people. So the Gemara says, V'haynu da'amar lehu navi li Yisrael, and that's what the Navi Micha means when he says to the Jewish people, Ami zecharna ma ya'atz balach melech Moav, u'ma'ano so bilam ben ba'or. So I'm quoting in between. The Gemara doesn't quote the whole pasuk in between. But we read this, by the way, as the Haftarah for Parshas Balak. So Micha says to the Jewish people, in the name of God, remember what Balak the king of Moab wanted to do to you, and remember what Bilam answered. And Bilam was very happy to do the job. And the section, a couple of psukim later, concludes, L'ma'an das tzidkos Hashem, in order that you should know the justice or the righteousness or the goodness of God. What does that mean? What's the connection? So Amar Rabbi Elazar, Amar lehem HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yisrael. What Micha was saying in the name of God was as follows. To the Jewish people. Du'u kama tzedakos asisi imachem. Know how much kindness, really, goodness I did with you. Shaloka asti bimei Bilam HaRasha. I never got angry in the days of Bilam HaRasha. Presumably, in that time period, he was trying to curse the Jewish people. She'ilmole ka'asti. Because had I gotten angry, lo nishtayer misoneim she'Yisrael sarad upalit. It's a euphemism. Not a single member of the Jewish people would have survived, because his curses would have totally wiped the Jewish people out. Vahenu de ka'amar le Bilam le Balak. That's what Bilam said, meant when he said to Balak, mo'ekov lo kabo el, u'mo'ezom lo za'am Hashem. So the simple reading of the pasuk is, how can I curse if God is not cursing them? How can I get angry if God is not angry at them? But what the Gemara says is, Malamed shekol osam ayamim lozan. Bilam was saying to Balak, listen, the way I do my trick of cursing people and having it work is I know when God gets angry. And that's the time when I strike when the iron is hot. And what am I supposed to do? The entire time I've been doing this, God never got angry. Ma'ekov lo kaba'el u'ma'ezom loza'am Hashem. Okay, that's what the Gemara says. That's why it didn't work. Now the Gemara repeats, but I think that this is a different source. Earlier was a brisa, and we're now in an Amoraic presentation. The Gemara says, "V'kama zamo?" How long is God's anger? And the Gemara answers, "Rega." Okay, that's the same answer as before, but now the Gemara says, "V'kama rega?" How long is a rega? So, "Amar Rabbi Abin v'itema Rabbi Avina, rega is kememre, rega. However long it takes to say rega, that's how long God gets angry." So that we've shown him here. Starting with Tosus, and this is also a Tosus on Avodah Zarah, ask a simple question. How was Bilam going to get in his curses within that time? Right? If it's a 16th of a second, or how long, even if you're a chazan and you schlep out rega, how long is it, you know, how much could Bilam get in there? So Tosus has two answers here. If you take a look, it's the top Tosus. It's a cute Tosus. Tosus says, Shomole ka'asti lo nishtayi b'kulei. V'im tomar. Maha Yayachal Lomar Bishas Harega. Bishas Rega. What could he possibly do in that time? So the Gemara says, Yesh Lomar, Bilam could have said, Kalem. Kalem means Kale Osam. Destroy them. So Bilam, you know, the amount the same, Rega is two syllables and Kalem is two syllables. So in the amount of time it would have taken Bilam to say, the amount of time it takes to say Rega, Bilam could have said Kalem. And the other answer, that's a cute answer. But I think the Lundish answer is really the second one. And I have the feeling that this may have some ramifications in halacha. V'inami, me'achar shahayamaschil kilalasa va'osa shah, hayamazik afil achar hakein. In other words, even if Bilam didn't have to finish the curses then, as long as you start the curses in between, you know, during that time, then everything, the way I would formulate this in a fashion of Lundus, is that everything that he would say in continuation would be attached to that one moment of the rega. Now, I've kind of wondered, I haven't done research on this, but I think that, you know, let me pose the following example. And I don't know the answer to the question. Supposing Zaman Kriya Shema is approaching, okay? We're now all davening in our own private shuls at home. And some people are early risers and some people are not early risers. Zaman Kriya Shema yesterday was 9:15. So all of a sudden, it's coming, the end of Zman Kriya Shema, and you start to rush, but you're really so far behind, and you're running through Birchas Kriya Shema. And then 5 seconds before, you get to the end of Zman Kriya Shema, you start to say Shema. Let's say 3 seconds before, so you don't even finish the first pasuk before Zman Kriya Shema passes. Are you Yotze or not? Now, I don't know that there's any practical ramifications, because if you're not Yotze, what are you going to do? It's too late. It doesn't make a difference. But, I'll pose a more pragmatic question. This sometimes happens at KJ and Erev Shabbos. Sometimes the calendar setter tends to set the mincha fairly late. I see Larry is smiling. And sometimes, forget the Chas and Shmoneh Esrei, or you could ask the same question. You start your Shmoneh Esrei before sunset, but the only 2 minutes to sunset, and you're not going to finish. And the question you could ask is, would it be better to daven privately earlier, or is it okay to, you know, wait to daven the minyan because you're starting it before Shkia, and I don't care when you finish your tefillah, I only care when you start your tefillah. I don't know the answers to any of these questions, but I know the answer to the last question, which is make mincha earlier on Friday afternoon. But nonetheless, in a general question, as a general proposition, what would we say in those cases? Does starting the thing within the time frame, does that mean that everything that you do afterwards is basically nigrar, it's dragged and attached to the first very moment? So again, I can't prove anything from Tosfos because this is not a halachic construct. It's purely an agadic one, but the second answer does raise a more important conceptual question. And so those are the two answers. Either Bilam could have said kalem, or Bilam could have started the klala and everything would have been attached to that particular part. Okay, fine. So now the Gemara says, Uminalan, the rega ratach. We're now on the sixth wide line in the Gemara. Very nice. God's anger is a rega. How do you know? We've established that God gets angry every day. The elzoim b'chol yom. But how do you know God's anger is a rega in Lent? So the Gemara says, Shenemar, ki rega biapo chayim birtono. So the way the Gemara reads that pasuk, so that pasuk is from Mizmar Lamed. We say Ashkenazim say every day before Baruch Shamar. It's not an easy pasuk to translate, but the way the Gemara is reading it is that his anger is for a rega, but when he is appeased, chayim, it is eternal life or something like that. So based upon this pasuk, rega be'apo. That's one possibility. The Ibo Yisema, there's a different verse that speaks about, but not explicitly about being God's anger, mehacha, which is chavi kimat rega ad yavor zan. This is always very, very good advice. It's a pasuk in Yeshaya, which Yeshaya says, lecha mi bo b'chadarecha. Go hide for the moment. When God's anger is passing by, you don't want to be around. So go hide yourself. Chavi kimat rega. Hide for a rega ad yavar zam, until the anger passes. So that's, and whose anger is it? It's the anger of God. So that's what the Gemara says. The Gemara says that God's anger is a rega based upon one of these two verses. So now here's the important question. So far, everything today is all abstract, but some of you might say, ah, but wouldn't it be useful to know when does God get angry? I have a few people I don't like. So what could I possibly do? So the Gemara says the following. The Gemara says, "Amar Abai, v'emas ratach." When does God get angry? He gets angry every day. Presumably, it's on God's schedule. He's got, you know, he gets his Google calendar in the morning, and it says at 10:03 p.m. and 43 seconds, that's your rega to get angry. 10:43 and 21 seconds until 21 seconds and 1/16 of a second. Right? When is it on God's calendar time to get angry? Amar Abaye, Abaye says, "Bahanach plashay kamaisa." It's sometime in the first 3 hours of the day. He chivra karbalasa the tarnagola, when apparently the something of the tarnagol, the rooster, like it's, I don't know, it's the thing on its head, is cold. White. Vikoi achad kara, and it's standing on one leg. I'm not into roosters and chickens. I don't know. I'm just going to take the Gemara at face value. So then the Gemara asks, but kol shayte v'shayte nami koi hachi. All the time chickens do that. The Gemara says, yes, but kol shaita, all the time, ispe shuriaki sumaki. There are red, probably, streaks. By hishata, lespe shuriaki sumaki. So when the rooster that normally has a red something or red tinges in its what do they call the thing on top of the rooster? What's the term?
Comb.
The comb, thank you. So when it's got the red stripes in there, then that's not that's not time of God's anger. When it turns all white, then that's when God gets angry. You'll see at the end of the Gemara, a few lines from here, what's the significance of that happening during the first 3 hours of the day. It has nothing to do with roosters. We'll see that in a moment. But now the Gemara tells a story. Ahu tzeduki, dahava b'shivavuse de Rabbi Shuben Levi, hava kametzar le tuva b'kroi. There was a tzeduki, it probably wasn't a tzeduki. It was likely to be a Christian in this case, who was always making Rabbi Yeshua ben Life's miserable, asking him questions from Tanakh. He was always trying to engage him in, let's call it, interfaith dispute about Psukim in Tanakh. So he was making Rabbi Shimon Levi's life very difficult. So Rabbi Shimon Levi had a great idea. Yom Achad, one day Rabbi Shimon Levi shakal tarnagola. He took a rooster, ukme ben kare da arsa. He put it between the legs of the bed, the ienba, and he watched it because he wanted to wait till the time that the rooster's comb turned completely white. Savar kimata hishaita alache. When that time comes, I'm going to curse him. I'll get rid of him that way. Kimata hishaita, when the time came, nayim. He dozed off. So he missed it. He missed this one opportunity. He was waiting for the ball to drop, and he fell asleep. So the Gemara says, you know what Rabbi Shimon Levi concluded from that? Amar shema mina lav orach ava lemevet hachi. It's not derech eretz to do that. Even if technically there's no isser, because let's say he was an apikoros, so cursing him wasn't prohibited, that's not derech eretz. Not the way to be as a human being. The rachamav al kol masav k'siv, God's mercy is upon all of his creatures.
Does that apply to his falling asleep, or does that apply to his the cone not changing colors?
I don't understand.
This might be his falling asleep that it's not derech eretz.
No. He's saying to curse someone, even if in some ways, if they deserve it, it's not derech eretz. Right? To curse this tzduki, where maybe there was no prohibition, and he was causing Rabbi Shimon Levi suffering, so that is inappropriate, even if it's not technically prohibited. Because God has mercy on all of his creatures. Uksiv, and also, this is very important, Gam anosh lat tzadik lo tov. For the tzadik to punish isn't a good thing. I like to quote this pasuk when I teach the smicha students. I usually on an annual basis, I go in to give them the fourth year smicha students who are going into the pulpit to give them a shir about correcting Kriyas HaTorah and what to do if you find an error in the middle of a Kriyas HaTorah in the Torah. What do you do then? So I always tell them about correcting Kriyas HaTorah, that whenever possible, the rabbi should not be the one correcting Kriyas HaTorah. Because when you have to correct people and embarrasses them a little bit, it doesn't make you a popular person. So it's always better to hand that duty off to some other gabbai, so the gabbai can be the bad guy. Because
that's Larry.
That's right. You give it to somebody
you
else.
Give it to my son-in-law.
He can be the object of people's ire, right? But the rabbi shouldn't have to be the one to do it. And so there are better reasons also. The rabbi has to be paying attention to everything else going on in the shul and not necessarily to correcting the Kriyas HaTorah. So give that to somebody else. But anyway, whether you like my application there or not, the Gemara here really expresses a fundamental point that sometimes people do things that are very frustrating and we would like to do nasty things to them, but we're supposed to emulate our maker. Rachamav al kol masav. It's not good to be in the habit of seeking to punish, having other people be punished. In a certain sense, what one would say is, leave to God what is God's. You do what you're supposed to do and let God take care of matters. Eventually, he makes the cheshbon work out. Okay, so anyway, so that's the end of the story of Rabbi Shimon Levi. And now the Gemara concludes this section or this piece, Tana Mishmed Rabbi Meir, Bisho Shachama Zorachas, when the sun starts to shine, V'chomalche Mizrach Umarav, Manichim Kisreim B'Rashehem, the kings, all the kings of East and West, they put their crowns on their heads, U'mishtachavim Lachama, and they bow to the sun, Miyad Koes HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So that's the time, apparently. It's the time when all the kings, the powerful people in the world, are now paying, showing obedience to the heavenly luminary, the sun. That's when God gets angry. That's the particular time. Okay, fine. So that is the end of this particular of this piece of God's anger. Okay, it was really only cited here. I suspect, by the way, that the primary location is in Avodah Zarah because some of the material from there has been cut out by the editors here, and I suspect it's only here because of Rabbi Yochanan's statement that you're not miratza other mishas kasa, you don't try to appease a person when at their height of the anger. And they quote the pasuk about God telling Moshe, which shows you that God gets angry, and that triggers everything else. Okay, fine.
Maybe God wouldn't have been angry had they removed their crowns, not put their crowns on. At least if they would have taken off their crowns, it would have shown their humility before one of God's servants, the sun. Somehow by putting on the crown, it almost seems like they're almost arrogant, saying, yeah, we're like you, son. we're like little. It's something about Manichim Kisrehem Bereshehem. It's not a sign of humility. If you bow before someone who you think is more important than you, you don't put your crown on, you take your crown off.
So, but Sam, I could argue the opposite. I will agree with one observation you're making, which I think is correct, is what is the significance Manichim Kisrehem Bereshehem? But I would think that if they put their crowns on their head to show that they're so important, they bow to the sun. If anything, it diminishes the importance of the sun. So the idolatrous defense is not as great. You know, maybe the argument would be is that we bow to the sun, but it's not really such a god because we'll put our crowns on our head. The question is, was there something, a ceremonial aspect to the king when he rose in the morning, put his crown on his head? I don't know. So I'm not sure that I think that your explanation is correct, but I think your question's a good question. I don't know the answer. Okay.
Well, do these kings even know any better? He's angry at them. I mean, are they Tinok Shenishba?
There's an assumption we work with
that
Bnei Noach are responsible for the Sheva Mitzvos, and the Gemara says that they don't have that Shogeg. When if you're Mechalo Shabbos, let's say you cook on Shabbos because you didn't know that cooking was Aser, that's called Omer Mutter, so you're a Shogeg. That's considered Shogeg, and you would bring a carbon. You're not Chayim Misa. The Gemara says that a Ben Noach who does something when he's Omer Mutter is Chayim Misa, because you say Hoya Lahem Lumot, that they should have known. And what I think that means is that by certain kinds of mitzvos, when morality is assumed to be self-evident, that you should have known. You don't have an excuse, well, I didn't know. So that seems to be that could very well be the assumption here. So I know that's a very complicated topic, the question of natural law and whether people would figure it out. But Chazal, in certain contexts, definitely seem to work with it. And certainly they stated explicitly by the Sheva Mitzvahs Bnei Noach. There is one parallel example that, I mean, it doesn't work perfectly, but there is one of the Sheva Mitzvahs that for a Jew also, Omer Mutter is not really a shogeg, which is murder. If you study the Gemara Makos, so if a person commits murder because they don't intend to actually commit the act, something slips, some cases that's a shogeg. But if you think it's mutter to kill someone and you kill someone, you don't go to Ari Miklat. Ari Miklat don't protect you, the city's your refuge, because the simple understanding is you should have known. Omer Mutter is more like, it's close to, it's not amazed, literally, it's not outright premeditated, intentional knowing, but it's close. It's what we call shogeg karov lemazed. So I think that that's the operative principle by the Sheva Mitzvos, by the seven Noahide laws, that the expectation is that they should know. But okay, I know that's common.
You're probably right about the crowns. It's like putting on a tie in KJ, putting your crown on before you dive in.
Okay, Rabbi Lookstein, I'm wearing a tie, but, you know, okay.
the reason God might be angry is that those kings derive the source of their kingship from the sun, rather than from God. So God gets angry, which is, by the way, the sun god was a major god mm-hmm. in Babylonia, Syria. It was the source of a lot of knowledge and the source of leadership. So God gets angry that they use the sun as their god rather than the omnipotent god.
I think that you're correct about that, although it still doesn't explain the part about Manichim Kisrei and Bereshehem. And in line with your comment, the reason I'm pretty sure that the reason the original name for the town Beit Shemesh, and probably is because it was a place where they worshipped the sun god. The sun shines all over the place in Israel. Some places more than others, but there are plenty of places that could have been called Beit Shemesh. But I'm willing to bet you that it was once upon a time a place of worship.
So I would also say that in terms of the image of the king putting the crown on his own head. So if you remember, there's a very famous picture of Napoleon placing the crown on his own head. It's a picture that appears, that there's a picture in the Louvre as well as in Versailles. The same picture appears with Napoleon crowning himself. So a king who crowns himself doesn't necessarily derive his power from God. He derives it from himself. But leave it.
Okay, so now the Gemara continues with another statement of Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Yose. The Amrat were about, I don't know, 12, 13 lines down. The Amrat Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Yose, Tova mardus achas belibo shel adam yoser mikama malkios. So Rabbi Yosei says that when a person takes something to heart themselves, when a person starts to ask the question, that's worth more than hitting them 100 times. We might say self-realization is more powerful than someone whacking over the head repeatedly. How do you know that? So they quote a pasuk from Hosea, Shenemar viritfa esme ahaveha. She will chase her lovers. This is the story here is, I think it's a discussion in the Gemara Pesachim whether this was real or whether this was a metaphor. Hosea, the prophet Hosea, was instructed to take a wife, but she's described as an
Ishes Denurim, as a
wife of harlotry. So the Gemara has a discussion, I think, whether this was real or it's just a metaphor, something like that. And he marries her and he has a few children. He gives them notable names. And then, of course, she strays because that's what she's supposed to do. And she has chased all her lovers. Finally, all of them have abandoned her. And what does she say? She says, El chav ashuvi, amra el chav ashuva el ishi harishon, ki tov li azmeata. I think I want to go back to my first husband. It was better for me then. That was the, that's the way it's described. And this is clearly whether Hosea is actually marrying a woman or not, which I tend to doubt. It's all a metaphor for the Jewish people and God, right? The Jewish people have strayed. Idolatry is compared metaphorically to adultery. It's betrayal of a covenantal bond. And after the Jewish people have gone astray, now they decide they want to come back to God. So Rashi explains, "V'ridfa tov mardus achas." You look at the third line in Rashi at the top of the page. Rashi says, "What is mardus achas? Lishon ridui v'hachna'a." Humbling and being ruled over. Some alibo sha'adam, some alibo me'elav. A person on his own says, you know what? Something's not working. And he continues, v'ridfa esme ahaveha, Rashi says, u'cheshetire she'ein ozer. When none of her lovers are interested, none are willing to help her, then tasim alibo lemar ashuba elishi harishon. What it basically means is that real change can only be accomplished when a person, and this kind of, it should be obvious, when a person starts to ask the questions of him or herself. That's when real change happens. A person can bang, hit you over the head 100 times, it's not going to make a difference until you decide internally to start to ask yourself the question. And now the Gemara says, Reish Lakish Amar, Reish Lakish says, no, it's worth more than a 100 malkios, right? The Rabbi Yochanan said it's worth more than any number of lashes. Rabbi Yochanan says it's worth more than 100. Shenemar teichas ge'ara b'mevin mehakos kisil mea. So I'm not. Rashi has a whole grammatical comment, but Rashi understands the Gemara reading the pasuk teichas ge'ara b'mevin means that when a person, the word techas is very hard to translate. The Rashi understands it's related to being broken, like al ti rabbi al techas, but it's not a verb, it's a noun. So in a person who's an understanding, a smart person, when there's internally, when he has a break, when he has a fear, when he finally asks the question, that's more effective than mehakos kisil mea. The simple sense meaning of the pasuk is that you can hit a fool 100 times, it's not gonna knock sense into him. But one rebuke of a mevin, of a smart person, he'll pick up on it. But the way the Gemara is reading it specifically here is that it's much more effective when it's internally generated.
So maybe the rabbinic lashing is called makos mardus. Maybe it means makos shemevi lamardus, that it's lashes that cause an internal change. You know, where it's somewhere. Well, no, just it's a drush, obviously. A chassidish of earth. I'm not saying that's
okay.
Drush, but...
Possible. Okay. All right. Now it gets really interesting.
Well, because that's the Rotsan, you know.
What's that? Yeah. In halacha,
the purpose is you have to say Rotsani.
Yes. But the assumption is, I think we work with the following assumption, Sam. When you beat a husband till he gives his wife a get, when a Beis Din does its job and beats the husband and he says Rotsani, he's doing what he really wants to do, the way the Rambam famously explains it, because things got in the way. But I would say the following. I'm willing to bet that once you stop hitting him And he said, wrote Simon, the next day, he's probably back to hating his ex-wife and regretting that he gave her a gift. But at the time he gave it, he really meant it. I don't think that that induces real change. That just gets him to do what he wants to do, really, in his deepest kishkas for a brief moment. It has to be kind of self-generated. He has got to wake up one day and say, that's really wrong. It's not who I want to be. Okay.
Now the Steinsgau says a comment about this, which it says this is a lesson of how to be a teacher, that hitting a child or hitting a student is not what you should be doing. You should teach him ba'ahava, and with love, that student will become, will learn the correct path.
Okay, I will add something as a teacher, coming from a different angle, not the emotional angle, but even the intellectual angle, which is that what you can get up and you can talk yourself blue in the face, explaining the questions and then giving the answers. But once a student on his own, the question clicks with the student, it's all easy after that. But it's got to come internally. You providing the question and then the answers, it doesn't really work. It's only when the question effect has piqued the student's interest, then the path is smooth after that. So, okay. Fine. Now the Gemara says the following. V'amar Rabbi Yochanan, Mishum Rabbi Yosei. Shlosha dvarim bikesh Moshe lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Moshe asked for three things from God, and God granted them. Now, this is related to the section we saw before. This is all in that very enigmatic passage in Parshas Kisisa, where Moshe asks God for something, and it's when he sees God, but he sees God from behind. It's all in that section. So what were the three things he asked for? So number one, Bikesh Moshe, Bikesh Shetishre Shechina al Yisrael, that the Shekhinah should continue to rest with the Jewish people, because it seemed like God wanted to kind of let them go on their own because he wasn't happy with the Egel. V'nosan lo, shenemar, halo b'lechtecha imanu. Moshe says, how will we know that that we have found favor in your eyes? Only if your Shekhinah goes with us. Number two, b'kei shlotish reshchina al ovdei kohavim. Moshe wanted Nevuah no longer to be given to any non-Jewish prophets. And God granted that as well. Shenemar v'niflinu ani ve'amcha. Moshe Rabbeinu asked that we will be distinct from your nation, from every other nation on the face of the earth. Mikol amasher al pnei adama. So that was Nevuah. I guess Bilam was kind of a legacy. But Bilam already had Nevuah, so Bilam's going to be the last one with Nevuah. Finally, Bikesh lehodio drachav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He asked God to tell him how God works in the world. V'nasanlo shenemar hodieni na estrachecha. I want to know your ways. And so, as we've spoken about before, the most pressing question for Chazal was the question of theodicy, and that's why Chazal placed this in Moshe Rabbeinu's mouth. When Moshe Rabbeinu said hodieni na estrachecha, he wanted to know how does God's justice work in the world. And the Gemara explains. Amar lefanav, ribono shalolam, mitmeima yesh tzadik v'tolo, v'yesh tzadik v'ralo, why is there tzadikim who prosper and tzadikim who suffer? V'rush, rasha v'tovlo, v'yesh rasha v'ralo. You have rishayim who prosper, and you have rishayim, you have evil people who suffer. What's going on? Amar lo, this is the first presentation of the Gemara. It's so fascinating, actually, because the Gemara is going to change this. But what did God say to Moshe? Amar lo, Moshe. Amar lo.
Moshe.
Tzadik, did he say Moshe?
Tzadik, yeah,
I guess Moshe. Tzadik. Kama. Tzadik v'tovlo, tzadik ben tzadik. When you have a righteous person who prospers, that's because he is the child of a tzaddik. He is a tzaddik, the child of a tzaddik.
His father.
Tzaddik v'ralo, tzaddik ben Rasha. He still suffers because of the taint of apparent sin. Then Rasha v'tovlo, who prospers, Rasha
ben tzaddik.
And finally, Rasha v'ralo, Rasha ben Rasha. Now, the Gemara immediately is going to jump up and say, hey, this doesn't make any sense. Amar mar. The Gemara now quotes from this price. Tzadik v'tovlo, tzadik v'tzadik ben tzadik, and tzadik v'rolo, tzadik ben Rasha. How can that be? Ini v'hoksid poked avon avos albanim. One pasuk in the Torah says that God visits the iniquities of the parents upon the children, meaning the parents sin and the children suffer for those sins. And another pasuk says uvanim lo yimsu al avos, that children don't die for the sins of their parents. V'raminan kroy ahadadi, we cast the two psukim in contrast and contradiction with one another. U'mishaninan, and we answered, lo kasha, ha'kish ochsen ma'aseh avosem b'yadeyem, and ha'kish ein ochsen ma'aseh avosem b'yadeyem. When children repeat their parents' sins, then they're punished for the parents' sins. When they don't repeat their parents' sins, they're not. So if you have a tzaddik ben rasha, how could it be that the tzaddik ben rasha suffers? After all, he doesn't suffer for his parents' sin. Now, I want to just make a sort of insert my little note here whenever I quote this drasha, is Chazal's resolution doesn't really solve the problem. In other words, it makes the world a little better, but at the end of the day, if you have a child who's a rasha and his parent or her parent was a rasha, I understand why the child is punished for his or her own sins. But why do they get a double heaping of punishment? They only did their own sin. So it's true. It's a little better than a tzaddik ben rasha, someone who's a tzaddik suffering for the sins of the parents. But it's still theoretically equally unfair that a rasha suffers for the sins of his or her parents. All right, some of the Rishonim attempt to, not here, but try to grapple with that particular question. But Chazal were trying to kind of ameliorate the problem of Poked Avon Avos Sabanim, because the truth is, Chazal were bothered probably on a theological level for two reasons. Number one is that, the inherent moral dilemma, which is that why should one person suffer for the sins of another person, even if it happens to be their parent? Number two, the Nevi'im already, Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel, point out that the people used to complain. They used to have a very popular metaphor, a popular parable. Avos achlu voser, v'shinei abanim tekena. The parents ate sour grapes, and it was the teeth of the children that gritted. So both Yechezkel and Yirmiyahu say that people will no longer say that, but ishpa avono yomus. Each person will only die in his own sin. Now, you could, there are more than one way to understand that, but the way Chazal probably would have said it is that the people got it wrong. They thought that God was punishing for their parents' sins, but they were really being punished for their own sins. And the Nevi'im are telling them that when they do tshuva eventually, they'll come to realize nobody's punished for a parent's sins. So Chazal really want to minimize on the idea that a child is punished for parents' sins. But if you want to talk about what pshuto shel mikra is, what is the simple resolution of the seeming contradiction between poked avono avos abanim, God visits the iniquities of the parents upon the children, versus the central verse of halachic jurisprudence that lo yumsu avos abanim, uvanim lo yumsu al avos, that parents and children are not punished for the other sins, ish bechatel yumasu. The simple resolution, I believe, is given by Rashbam, which is that Beisdin is never allowed to punish one individual for the sins of another. A child for a parent's sins, a parent for a child's sins. But God works on his own cheshvan. God, we don't know how God works, and sometimes God seems to, or maybe does, visit the iniquities of parents upon their children. Just take one of the classic, most difficult moral dilemmas in halacha, moral dilemma, it's morally troubling, mamzerus. The idea of a mamzer. A parent have an affair, and a child is born, and that child is the one who suffers the stigma. That you don't get more poked avon avos abanim. Now, Beis Din doesn't punish anybody. That's God's doing. So the pshat, one could have argued, is the way I think Rashbam does, is poked avon avos abanim only is referring to God, and lo yumsu avos abanim, and that's what the words mean. Yumas means to be put to death. God doesn't, we don't say by God that he's yumas. God, it just says that God will kill him, or he will die. It doesn't say yumas refers to Beis Din. So that would have been the pshat, but Chazal were uncomfortable theologically with that, maybe because of psukim in Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel, maybe because they're just inherently it's difficult. And so Chazal greatly narrowed the scope down of poked avon avos abanim only to when children are repeating the sins of the parents. But at least on a superficial level, it doesn't really solve the problem, certainly not completely, because the children should still not be punished for their parents' sins, only for their own sins. Okay, but that's what the Gemara says. It can't be. It can't be God told Moshe that the tzaddik who suffers is a tzaddik ben Rasha, the tzaddik the child of a Rasha, and that the Rasha who prospers is a Rasha ben tzaddik. Can't be. So the Gemara says, no. Elahachi ka'amar lei. This is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to him. Tzaddik v'tovlo, tzaddik gomor. When you see a righteous person who is prospering, that's because he's a complete tzaddik. Tzaddik v'ralo, a tzaddik who is suffering, is tzaddik she'eno gomor. He's not a perfect tzaddik. He is a tzaddik, but he's not perfect. Russia v'tovlo. They have a Russia who's prospering, it's because Rosh Hashanah Gomer, he's not a total Rasha, so God has to reward him for his mitzvos in this world so he can punish him completely in the next world. And finally, Rasha Viralo is a Rasha Gomer. He has no merits, so he prospers neither in this world nor in the next world. Now, the truth is, once you give this answer, the Gemara, you have, not really, but in a certain sense, solved the problem of theodicy. Because you ask a question, why is a certain righteous person suffering? So if you ask most people, we would say there's no righteous person who's perfectly righteous. There's almost no such thing as a tzaddik gomor. So if he's a tzaddik and he did a few things wrong, that's how we can explain the punishment. Not totally comforting, but on an arithmetic level, it kind of answers the question. Okay, but perhaps the next line in the Gemara will speak more to some of us. Upliga the Rabbi Meir. The claim of Rabbi Yosei, that God answered Moshe in the affirmative on all three questions, particularly the last one is the issue, namely that God explained to Moshe how God divine justice works in this world. Rabbi Meir disagrees. The Amar Rabbi Meir, Shtayim Nasnu Lo, Ala Achas Lo Nasnu Lo. One of them, two of them he was granted, namely to prophecy should dwell amongst the Jewish people, and prophecy should not rest amongst the non-Jews. But the third one he wasn't granted. Shenemar, God said to Moshe, V'chanosi es asher achon, I will have favor, shine favor upon the person I choose to shine favor, afal pishe nohagun, even if he doesn't deserve it, v'richamti es asher arachem, afal pishe nohagun. And I will have compassion on individual that I choose to have compassion on, and the Gemara adds, even though he doesn't deserve it. I don't like to engage in rabbinic biography generally because it's highly speculative, but it's not surprising that Rabbi Meir, with what he experienced in his lifetime, with the loss of his children and then his wife, that maybe it's not surprising that Rabbi Meir took a view of divine justice that was simply inscrutable. Rabbi Yosei had a relatively speaking more comfortable life. Rabbi Yosei was both more successful from a halachic perspective, and in a very famous story in Shabbos, the Gemara refers to Rabbi Yehuda Bar Ilai as the Rosh HaMedabrim B'chol Makom. It's actually, that title is quoted on the last Amud of our Masechta, on the Samach Dal Amud Aleph in Brachos. Rabbi Yehuda Bar Ilai, Rabbi Yehuda, was called Rosh HaMedabrim, the first of the speakers. So the Gemara wants to know, why was Rabbi Yehuda Bar Ilai called the Rosh HaMedabrim? So the Gemara says, because it was a story that happened. There was a conversation with three Tanoim. There was Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yosei, and Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Yehuda said, look how wonderful the Romans are. They build bathhouses for everybody to bathe in. They build the marketplaces so people can get all these goods. And they build bridges so people can travel, something like that. Rabbi Yosei said nothing. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai said, they build bridges so they can take tolls. They build marketplaces so they can put prostitutes there, et cetera, et cetera. Somebody in the Beis Medrash, unfortunately, retold the conversation when he shouldn't have. And then it spread and spread and spread. It was Yehuda ben Gerim until it got back to the Romans. And the Romans declared the following. Rabbi Yehuda, who spoke highly of the Romans, will be elevated. And that's how he became the Rosh HaMedabrim B'chol Makom, the first of the speakers. Rabbi Yosei, who remained silent, will go into exile. He went to Tzipore. And Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai will be put to death. And that's why Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai went and fled and hid in a cave for 24 years, or wherever long it was. So it's not surprising, perhaps, Rabbi Meir wasn't part of the conversation, but he suffered greatly. Rabbi Yosei didn't suffer that much. And so Rabbi Meir is the one who says that, V'chanosias asher achon, v'richamtias asher arachem. So now, concluding this section, the Gemara says, V'yomer, the next part in that parsha, in Kisisa, Vayomer lo sucha lerosas panai. God says to Moshe, you will not be able to see my face. Tana mishmei de Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha. Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha taught, kach amar lea kadosh baruch hu lemoshe. You know why God wasn't willing to reveal that to Moshe? He says, kishiratisi leratisa. When I wanted to reveal myself to you that you should see, you weren't receptive. You didn't want it. Achshav sha'ata rotza, now that you want it, ani eni rotza. I don't want it. What was it that Moshe refused God's offer to see at the burning bush, right? Vayaster Moshe panav ki yarei me habid el ha'elokim. Moshe didn't want to look at that time. And so this story, according to Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha's version, and we're about to see a different take on that, Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha said that was Moshe Rabbeinu's chance. Afterwards, he lost it. God was interested then. Moshe wasn't ready. Later, Moshe was interested. God wasn't ready to share it then. And now the Gemara says, but that take on Moshe Rabbeinu's behavior at the burning bush, which sees it as a negative that he looked away instead of trying to contemplate the divine, pliga the Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani, Amar Rabbi Yonasan. That argues in Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani, Rabbi Yonasan's position, the Amar Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani, Amar Rabbi Yonasan, bischar shalosh, zaha l'shalosh. Moshe merited three gifts because of three things that he did. Number one, bischar, vayaster Moshe panav, because Moshe refused to look at the divine countenance out of humility, and maybe he wouldn't engage in mystical speculation. It was inappropriate to look. He was rewarded with zachar leklaster panim, the rays of light that emanated from him was a reward for that. Bischar ki yare, because he was fearful, zacha levayiru migeshes elav. The Jewish people were in awe and fear of Moshe. They were afraid to approach him. And finally, bischar mehabit, because he refused to look. Mehabit, zacha, he was rewarded with ulismunas Hashem yabit. Moshe had a clarity of vision and prophecy that no other prophet ever possessed. And they're using all the words, at least the last two cases, they're using the words that are parallel. Yare, ki yare mehabit el ha'elokim, he was afraid, and vayiru migeshes elav, they were afraid to approach him. And he was afraid, mehabit, and therefore it was usmunas Hashem yabit. Okay, so that ends, just about ends this section. And I'm going to read only one more line, and perhaps we will understand why is it that this whole sequence of Gemaras is here. These are beautiful agados. I love these agados. But what are they doing here? I mean, it started with, how do you know that God davens? I mean, I know we're learning brachos, but nice. But why is this whole section of Rabbi Yose, of Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Yose doing here? And I think it's the next line that links back to one of the previous Gemaras that we did, which is the Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Basirosias Kapi, V'ra'isas Acharai. When God says to Moshe, I will remove my hand and you'll see me from behind, what does that mean? Amar Rav Hana Bar Bizna, Amar Rabbi Shimon Chasida, Melamed Shehara Kadosh Baruch Hu L'Moshe, Kesher Shel Tfilin. It teaches you that God showed Moshe Rabbeinu the knot of his tefillin. Now, if you remember, when you go back to the Vav Amin Aleph at the bottom, where we sort of started really going off on a tangent, not that we haven't been going off for a while, so the Gemara spoke about God's tefillin and what was written in God's tefillin, and now we have the Kesher Shel Tfilin of God. Okay. Anyway, we'll stop here. The Gemara is almost done. It's not yet done with the statements of Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Yose, there's one more to go, but we will begin with that, God willing, next Sunday, and then continue on to explore Rabbi Yochanan in the name of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Any questions?
Did you say that there's going to be a different way of getting in to see you? I have no idea how I get in.
Okay, so what I will say is I can stop the recording for this 1 second.